Hey everyone, it's been a little while. I'm sorry about that. Hopefully, now that the book has been published, my plan to continue the Patreon a little more consistently will come to fruition. So my plan at this point, just to start this off at first, hello, my name is Trevor Strunk, Hegelbon on Twitter. This is the Patreon episode. Up until Christmas, I'm going to do a bit of a 30 days of Christmas thing for all you who are either dreading or looking forward to the holidays, where I will be doing an episode a day. So starting from today, that is November 23rd, 2021, we will have daily podcasts. From then, I found that daily podcasts are a little tough. If I'm loving it, maybe I'll keep it up. But probably what will happen is every week, I will record an episode of a Patreon episode, either, you know, on one of the various formats that we do on Monday. And if I can manage it, another time in the weekend. But for this month, I'm hoping that we will have a number of solo episodes that you will really enjoy to kind of grease the holidays along. The one I'd like to start with today is I'd like to restart my long dormant Homicide rewatch. This is Homicide Season 1, Episode 2 that we'll be talking about today. And if you forgot about the last episode, I will be linking it on my Twitter. And also, hopefully, you can find it in the show notes or click on the various tabs that'll get you there. I think it's fairly well marked off. But we're covering the wonderful, you know, David Simon, Barry Levinson, et cetera, show Homicide. And, you know, one of the things I talked about in the first episode was how this show doesn't lionize anyone in the same way that we get this sense of you know, no one being a hero in David Simon's maybe more well-known work, The Wire. In this, it truly is like, like everyone in this is just so throwaway, sort of like glib, strange, any sort of actual sort of complaint, as we saw in the first episode with the strange affirmative action argument between two of the partners, one Italian and one African-American. The Italian one was saying that he needed not affirmative action, excuse me, the discrimination one. He kept saying that his black partner was discriminating against him because he was Italian. I'm going to get these people's names because I'm going to forget them, other than Bayless and Frank. But yeah, so this would be. We're just getting back into it. Yeah, I'm sorry. These are not characters that are in the whole thing. Meldrick is one of them, so that's Clark Johnson. He's in the whole thing. But his partner, who I think is maybe, I don't know, he's someone. But he's great too. He's wonderful. He's an Italian sort of like, kind of like a greasy guy. He sort of plays very, very greasy. But it works. It's really great. In any case, putting all that aside, the way that Meldrick and his partner deal with the sense of, you know, propriety between them, this literal sort of like, I'm taking the discrimination claim up to the higher elements in the department. And then, you know, following up with, oh yeah, actually like, it's all a joke and we're just going to like laugh at it all and not take it seriously. Like this element of extremely serious and like seriously taken, actions by the detectives in the show are then balanced with this utter disregard for, I don't know. I don't want to say continuity, but ramifications. There's no consequences, and not in the sense of like, oh, you know, these are cops. You never have consequences put against them. They are, but like even the sort of everyday consequences, like this is so loose and ephemeral that when things like the murder that happened in the last episode, the Adina Watson murder happens and sort of like occupies the realm of Homicide, it hits so much harder because everything else has been so ephemeral. And I mean this in a very good way. Like I think this show is extraordinarily well written, well shot, well directed. it is fast paced, but it is also a little dull. The stories, like, so in this episode, there are a bunch of B stories. We'll get to Dina Watson, but, the sort of sub stories, John Munch, who we see is the same Munch as in SVU. He transcends, these shows in a certain way. Very, very interesting. Him and Ned Beatty playing as Stan Bolander, who recently passed away, RIP to a wonderful actor, are kind of, they're researching whether or not an older woman killed her husband of 60 years, because they respond to his death and he gets up and says he's not dead, and they start yelling at each other. Later they find him dead on his cellar stairs. And so it's this go around, essentially like a philosophical conversation about a marriage, that plays into this question of Bolander wanting to date the ME. It's fascinating. Like, it's just, it's a great, it's a great sort of like silly B plot that still has like a murder maybe at the center of it. But unlike a Law and Order, for instance, the murder is made like extraordinarily secondary. Like, it doesn't matter, right? Like, it like utterly does not matter if this woman did or did not kill her husband. Just like utterly pointless, right? So that B plot, and then the B plot where let's see, the actress's name is Melissa Leo. Her character Kay Howard and her partner actually played quite well. I got to give him credit for it. You'd think I wouldn't, but Daniel Baldwin plays her partner, Beau Felton, quite well. Felton thinks she hears a ghost telling her where a murder weapon is, right? She's getting pressure from the case, all this stuff, and Felton doesn't believe her. Sort of like there's some tension there. He's not taking her seriously enough. And as the wonderful Yaphet Kotto, Lieutenant Girardello, says, you know, like, if I don't believe in any of that stuff unless it works, right? And so this B plot ends with a kind of moment wherein Felton and Howard get to nail this guy that they're trying to nail, who you know, speaks like an oracle, says things like, you know, it's the first time we ever saw the color blue, it was 100 years ago, stuff like that. They finally nail him, Felton says that it was due to tarot cards, and none of this is given closure, right? In typical cop shows and typical police procedurals today, what we get when we get these storylines is a sense of closure, right? It's a sense of like, oh, what he really did was like, he played he realized his partner was freaked out by the voice of this ghost. And so he played a recording of the ghost for the perp, and the perp was like, oh, I'm terrified, and moved his gun. Right. We find a way to explain the ghost away as stress, or we say that the ghost was real and that's what's haunting him, or something like that. Right. In this case, we get no clarification on whether or not, Detective Howard was hearing voices or actually hearing a ghost. We get no clarification on whether or not the perp was not sleeping because he too was hearing the ghost. We get no clarification as to how Felton actually found the gun. It is, like so many things in this episode, like not important to understand those elements. What's important to understand is the relationship between the two characters. And I think what's kind of remarkable about Homicide is that these are relationships between these two characters that are not premised on them being police officers, right? We don't get the sort of thin blue line, you know, like it's complicated being with your partner or whatever, right? The elements of what's going on here between these characters is they're very much like just two characters who happen to share a lot of time and a lot of work with each other. It is much more like watching people at an office building than watching, you know, the lionization of police officers as we have seen it, right? Now, what's fascinating about that too is, so we get to the Adina Watson case, which is the central case for this entire season. I ended the last episode talking about them finding the body, and we start this episode with the young detective, Tim Bayless, played by Kyle Secor, saying like, oh, what did I miss? What am I missing? What am I missing? What am I missing? And this question of like, what am I missing? Who did this? What can't I see? Is like absolutely a driving thing in this show, right? As a viewer, you also are asking yourself, what am I missing? What am I missing? What am I missing? Oftentimes, it's what the show doesn't want to give you, right? Did that lady kill her husband? Doesn't matter. Did Felton have some other way of finding the tarot card, like finding out how the perp was moving his gun, or was it that he just tailed him like it looks like? Yeah, you know, maybe that was it too. It doesn't really matter what the explanations of those things are. Those are all just backdrops to have basically interpersonal communication, sort of like David Mamet style, between like two people, right? And maybe not even David Mamet, maybe almost like Sam Shepard or something like that. It's essentially just like a psychodrama between two people that have quite a bit of fondness for each other, but also are nothing alike, right? As much weight is given to these murders outside of Dina Watson as is given to Bolander's decision to ask the ME out or not, right? Like, this is ultimately the point. The controversy around the murder of the husband is like, well, what would you do to get out of a bad marriage, right? And it's not I have to clarify this. It's not like sexism, right? Like, it's not like, oh, this broad wouldn't get out of the marriage, or like, oh, I would kill my wife like to be single. It literally is like, this guy was just recently divorced and he is like, he's struggling with the concept. Like, the idea is a struggle for him. And thus it colors his view of this case. And he has to deal with this woman who he also has feelings for, taking the opposite perspective as the ME. He says it's not murder. She says it is. It's much more about the psychodrama between people. However, the Adina Watson case is like sort of like the central case. It's meant to be the case that means something. And this is where it diverges from The Wire a lot. Where in The Wire, we get stuff like, you know, like, you know, where's Wallace, right? Where's Wallace String? Where's Wallace? We find out where Wallace is. And in fact, like, we as an audience watch this sort of like emotional thing where Michael B. Jordan's character is sorry about spoilers for season one of The Wire, killed off. And, you know, we have to watch the sort of fallout from that. And the fallout is like extraordinarily, you know, it's riveting TV, but it's like, it's broken down for you piece by piece. Everyone involved gets their comeuppance one way or the other. And so that, as opposed to Adina Watson, as we'll see in later episodes, like, this is truly, you know, everyone is emotional. Everyone is upset. Bayless, it's his first case. He is like, he's, you know, again, another cliche, the rookie on his first case. The more sort of like experience, Frank Pembleton, who ends up being his partner, who's sort of sitting on the sidelines, the rest of the group who don't really respect him, the lieutenant, Al Giardello, trying to like help him out, to like light a fire under his ass. Like, all this stuff is absolutely happening in this episode. However, what also is happening is that none of it effectively matters, right? Like, this Sturm und Drang, this parlor drama, this kind of like genre-based backdrop for the Adina Watson case, it produces exactly nothing as far as results go, right? Bayless is told by this reporter, who he's told is like Godzilla, he's gonna have to learn to deal with her, she's like, she's real tough. She tells him like, hey, I know something, this lady knows something, you're gonna want to talk to her. And like, what ends up happening is he goes and talks to this woman, and this store owner gets a suspect and finds out within seconds of interviewing him at the station, within seconds of Frank Pembleton interviewing him, he's not a good suspect. He's nothing. He's like, he's lost for leads. They don't find anything in their big search. There's no smoking gun. And Giordano says to him, you know, these things pop, and sometimes they take a while, but they'll pop. But you don't get the feeling he's confident. You don't get the feeling anyone's confident. Like, in something like SVU, right? Law and Order SVU, there's this confidence that if you are emotive enough and you care enough and you want something enough, it will come to you if you are the just party. Not only are the police not clearly the just body in homicide, like, they're the body you follow, but like, they don't do nice things to get their results all the time. And they're not particularly effective. But also, it doesn't really matter that Bayless tearfully visits Adina Watson's funeral at the end. It doesn't matter that he really wants to solve this to prove himself. It doesn't matter that he seems to actually care about the family. There's no handicapping for morality in the world of homicide. And it makes for a much better storyline and one that does not lionize the police. We could like these characters all we want, but they're obviously flawed and they're obviously sort of like strange, subjective, you know, is Howard hearing the voice of a ghost or is she tired because she's trying to get all her completions up? And if she is tired, as all of them seem to be, and overworked, how sure can they possibly be that they're arresting the right people? The show, like, honestly, the show revels in this. Like, it really honestly cares a lot about this. And so as a result, like, everything about the psychodrama of the Adina Watson thing feels as if, it feels as if like the, I'm trying to think how to say this. It feels as if it is a super serious daytime story, like primetime story from a police procedural dropped in the middle of a show that is like incapable of handling such a story with the gravitas we're expected to understand, which is to say, a false gravitas and an idea of heroes and villains and victors and vanquished and, you know, feeling some sense of catharsis in the end. And as a result, what Homicide does is it takes a super serious story and puts it in the framework of the other stories that are so like ephemeral. And so what we get is, in fact, like an utterly sort of like, I don't know how to say it, like it. It's extraordinarily compelling, but you kind of know from the beginning that there's no real even hope that this is going to be solved in a way that you want it to be solved. And so you as the audience are getting your expectations ripped to shreds gleefully by the show in its centerpiece plotline. And it is fascinating. Even two episodes in, it is clearly playing with audience expectations as to closure that we're going to see really, really amp up by episode 5 of this season. So anyway... great episode. Really excited to be talking about this again. I'm like super amped about the show and I hope it comes through. We'll probably do another episode of this tomorrow. Honestly, probably just keep going until we get through at least season one. And yeah, thank you for being a patron. Thanks for supporting me. I appreciate it through thick and thin. And I hope you're having a great day. Oh, buy my book, Story Mode. It's available on Amazon and Bookshop and Powell's and all those places. Story Mode. I forget the subtitle, but you can find it if you look up Trevor Strunk, Story Mode. Thanks, everyone.
Well, 2,000 years ago in far-off Samaria, there was a woman who thought just like you did. Listen to what Jesus said to her. Jesus said, if you only knew what a wonderful gift God has for you and who I am, you would ask me for living water. She's the woman at the well. Our God loves her.